Okay, Parshas Kisiso, page 484. Okay. This Parsha has many different topics, including the tragedy of the Egel Hazor, the golden calf, which takes a long part of the parsha. In fact, there's an interesting verse before we continue to start the parsha, that if you look at Parshas Kisiso, it's a bit disproportionate in terms of how the call-ups are divided. Right? Normally in any parsha, they're pretty even, but in Parshas Kisiso, we know that Rishon and Levi, the first two aliyas, are very, very long, and the others are very, very short. And they say a vort, that one of the reasons for that is as follows, that there's a halacha that you're not supposed to call someone up to the Torah if that particular portion mentions a mitzvah or transgression that you know the person is guilty of. Because right? It's embarrassing. So the problem with the Egel Azor, the problem with the golden calf, is that we all participated in the golden calf. We all were in trouble. With the exception of the tribe of Levi. So, when I say we're all guilty, I mean the men actually, not the women. we call up the men, right? So, except for the tribe of Levi. So that's why there's a vort that we make Parshas Kisiso, we make the first two aliyahs very long in order to get the story of the golden calf into the second aliyah, which is the aliyah of the Levi. In order to so we don't call up a regular yid for the golden calf, so they shouldn't be guilty of it. Anyway.
Rabbi, does that mean that anybody who's had a conviction is not allowed to be called up?
Not going to be called up. You shouldn't call them up in the portion that deals with these.
I mean this particular.
No, in the portion that deals with that particular transgression.
Now I'm talking about in general.
Yeah, so if a person's a murderer, for example, if he's been convicted of murder, you can call him up, but you can't call him up in the aliyah, which says he shouldn't murder.
Can I just say something about apropos? At what age does one tell a child about the Ten Commandments? I'll tell you what, can I just interrupt? I've got a little granddaughter of 6, just started school in America. So she stole something in the class, so they sent her to the principal, and the principal punished her that she was not allowed to go out for play for a week. When she came home, her father said, and it says in the Torah, you must not steal. So she said, so why didn't you tell me? why didn't anybody tell me?
Well, all I can say is that she's got a very bright future because she's
a very bright little girl. Yeah, so but that's what she said. She said, so why didn't you tell me?
Yeah, good on her. Oh well.
Sorry to interrupt the lesson.
That's okay. That's a good story. Okay. Anyways, that's the Parshas Kisiso. So. However, the first part of the parasha deals with the mitzvah of machtzis hashekel, giving of a half a shekel. Let's have a look at it. It's the first parasha. It's the mitzvah of a half a shekel, which we'll try and go into a little bit, and then we'll try and go into some other stuff. Okay. So it says, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Leimer, Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, saying, Kisiso es roish b'nei Yisrael. Now, the parasha is called Kisiso, and the word Kisiso actually is problematic in terms of translation. Because it can mean when you count, or it can mean when you receive. So essentially, the phrase has to be read together. Kisiso as roish b'nei Yisrael lifkudehem. When you receive the census of the Jewish people for their counting. In other words, when you count the Jewish people. So Hashem says, when you count the Jewish people, what has to happen? V'nosnu ish koifer nafshoy l'Hashem. Each person should give an atonement for his soul to Hashem. Bifkoid oisam when you count them. Layiye bohem negef bifkoid oisam. And therefore there will not be a plague when you count them. In other words, like this. Really what's happening in this parasha is actually two things. What we're about to learn is a mitzvah that every year there was like a tax that every person had to give half a shekel. And we'll see what it was used for in a minute. But besides that, the Torah is introducing this mitzvah with a different concept, and that is that the half a shekel was also used to count the Jewish people. Because what the Torah is telling us is that you're not allowed to count people, and therefore if you want to count them, You have to get them to donate something, and then you count that object. Okay? So let's have a look at the next pasuk, we'll see. Ze yitnu, this is what they should give. What should they give? Kol ha'over al pkudim, all those that are passing through the census, all those that are going to be counted. They should give machtsis ha-shekel b'shekel ha-kodesh. They should give a half a shekel using the currency called shekel ha-kodesh, the holy shekel. Esrim geira ha-shekel. Now the Torah explains that the shekel was a currency that was made up of 20 geira. Geira is a type of coin. And what they have to give is half. Machtsis ha-shekel, half the shekel. Teruma la-Hashem. It has to be given as a donation, as a contribution to Hashem. Alright. So the Torah, really, again, like I said, there's actually two things. This mitzvah of giving half a shekel had to be done every year throughout the Beis Hamikdash. There was a mitzvah to give half a shekel every single year. But the Torah is also saying that in the time of the desert, it was used to count the people as well, because the Torah is instructing us that we're not allowed to count people, because counting people emphasizes their existence, and that's a problem with the concept of Ayin Hara, the evil eye. And therefore, we're not actually permitted to count them in that way. And therefore the Torah says you count them, but you count them through an object. Now it's an interesting thing. On the one hand, the Torah encourages us to count people, because the Torah, a few times during the desert, we know that Hashem commanded the Jewish people to be counted, right? And yet there's a thing about not counting them openly. So counting is a good thing and it's a bad thing. How's counting a good thing? Counting is a good thing because we have a concept like this in the Gemara discusses the following concept. There's an idea, you know, like in treif and kosher, you have something called bittul. Bittul means if a little bit of treif falls into a lot of kosher, right? Or if, I don't know, if one treif thing got mixed up, if one treif dish got mixed up with many treif dishes or something, there's a concept of, and you're not sure where it is, there's a concept of bittul that can become nullified. Like sometimes you follow the majority, or sometimes 60 times as much, you say it becomes nullified, etc. Right? But there are certain things that the Gemara discusses that don't become bottled, that never can become neutralized, never can become nullified. One of the things is called a dovar shebeminyan, something you count. What does that mean? For example, when you go to the store and you buy something, so it depends what you buy, right? Certain things you buy by weight, let's say, or packet, right? You buy a packet of cherries, or a pound of cherries, or a kilo of cherries, right? You don't go to the store and say, I want a dozen cherries, right? You don't do that. But there are certain things that you count, you buy by number. So, for example, you would buy a dozen eggs. Eggs, the Gemara says, this goes back all the way back to the Gemara's times. You don't buy a half a kilo of eggs, you buy a dozen eggs, right? You count them by number. The Gemara says something that's counted by number has a certain chashivus, has a certain importance, and because of its importance, it doesn't become bottled, never becomes nullified. So, therefore, one of the concepts of counting the Jewish people was that when Hashem counted us, he brought out in us this concept that we are an important nation. And therefore, even though we happen to be the minority, we're considered one sheep among lamb, among 70 wolves, etc., we never become bottled, we retain our significance. We'll never become integrated, our identity will never disappear, so to speak, and come dissolved, because we are a dovar shebeminyan, we're a counted thing, right? So the idea of counting emphasizes the importance. On the other hand, we have a concept in Yiddishkeit that we never try to expose any individual to unnecessary scrutiny or unnecessary exposure. The Gemara says that ein hadavar, ein habracha shoru ela b'davar asamu min ha'ayin, which means bracha only rests on something which is hidden from the eye. So the idea of modesty, the idea of tznius, the idea of not publicizing something. We have generally a lot of customs in Yiddishkeit to have, like, people don't unnecessarily talk about what they have, or you don't publicize things that are going to happen before they happen. Why? Because it's the idea of keeping it in the background so that it's more susceptible to the bracha of Hashem. And the same thing over here, that we don't count people directly, because that counting them exposes them to a sort of level of scrutiny from Hashem, and that exposes them to the concept of Ayin Hara, and therefore we don't do that. So how do you count people? You count people through them giving something, and you count the things, right? This, of course, has great relevance today when we count people for a minion, for example, or that kind of thing, right? You never count people, you don't say 1, 2, 3, 4, you either count them with a posuk, right? The minog in the shul is when you want to see if there's enough men for a minion, you don't say 1, 2, 3, 4, you say Hashia, Esamecha, Varachas, Machal, Asecha, use a posuk. Because that we're not counting them, or there's a minog in Yiddish, you say Nisht Eins, Nisht Svei, say not one, not two, not three. In other words, you don't count them. Why? Because the Torah says that there shouldn't be a plague. If you count them, they're susceptible to a plague, which is what happened in the time of Dovid HaMelech. In the time of Dovid HaMelech, Dovid HaMelech wanted to do a census. for the Jewish people, and either him, I remember the exact story, him or his based in, mistakenly understood that the prohibition that the Torah gives against counting people was only a prohibition that applied in the desert, and it wasn't something that applied going forward. And that was actually a mistake. Right? Because it applies always. And therefore, in David HaMelech's time, they counted people without giving them half, without them giving a half a shekel, and there was a disease broke out, and there was a plague, and therefore they learned that it was something that applied always, it wasn't only in the times of the Midbar. Yeah. Okay, but apart from that, as I said, the mitzvah of half a shekel was a yearly mitzvah. It was a mitzvah that had to be given every single year. And the Torah refers to it as a koifer nafshoi, as an atonement. Right? And it's interesting because the pasuk says, ze yitnu. This is what they have to give. They have to give every year a half a shekel. And the Rambam says that the way it was given was, it had to be a whole half a shekel, meaning the half a shekel had to be given in one time. Couldn't give it in installments, you couldn't pay it off. Right? It had to be given as one complete giving. Why is that? So there was a great Gaon, a great genius called the Rogatchover Gaon, who lived in the last generation. And he explained like this, and something will develop soon. He explained that because the Torah calls the half a shekel koifer nafshoi, an atonement for one's soul, so he says that the giving of a half a shekel was almost like giving a korban, it was like a sacrifice. Because the Torah says that it achieves an atonement for, and we'll see in a minute what kind of atonement it was. And because it was an atonement, the actual giving of the sacrifice was like an atonement, therefore it had to be given like a korban. Just like a korban, when you give a sacrifice, it has to be perfect, it has to be without a blemish, it has to be in one sort of one giving, so too the half a shekel had to be a perfect giving, it had to be given in one time, it couldn't be given broken up, it couldn't be given in installments, because it had the halachic status of a korban, and therefore it had to be this like perfect giving. And the Torah continues, and we'll come back to this in a second. Pasuk Yudalib 14. Kol ha'over al-apkudim, all those that are counted, miben esrim mishana v'mala, which included all those males from 20 years upwards, because the Torah in a different place says that the way that the census was taken in the desert was always taken with the men who were of military age. The military age was men between the ages of 20 and 60. Right? Yitain trumas Hashem, they should give the truma to Hashem. Ha'ashir lo yarbe, the wealthy may not give more. The hadal lo yamit, and the poor cannot give less. Gemachtzis Hashekel. Lase says trumas Hashem, to give this donation to Hashem, l'chaper al nafshe seichem, as an atonement for their souls. V'lokachtos kesef ha-kippurim, therefore, now what should you do with this money? Says the Torah, v'lokachtos kesef ha-kippurim, you shall take this atonement money, me'eis b'nei Yisrael, from the Jewish people. The nasata oisai al avodas oil moed, you shall give it for the work of the Mishkan. The hoyal ifnei Yisrael lezikaron, and it'll be for the Jews as a remembrance. Ifnei Hashem, before Hashem, lechaper, again, Torah says lechaper al nafshaseichem, to atone for your souls. What does it mean it was given to the Mishkan? So Rashi explains that it was given to purchase the sacrifices, the korbanos, right? Because we know that in the Mishkan and subsequently in the Mishkan in Eretz Yisrael in the Beis Hamikdash, there were daily korbanos. And the korbanos always divided themselves into two parts, right? There was something which we call korbanos yochid, individual sacrifices. What that means is, those were the sacrifices, the korbanos that people would bring on their own, either by way of donation, like someone just felt that he wanted to bring a korban to Hashem, they would bring an animal, or sometimes it was an obligation, for example, a woman who gave birth had to bring a korban, or someone who sinned had to bring a korban, all different types of korbanos. That's called korbanos yochid, individual korbanos. And that, of course, is paid for by the person bringing the sacrifice. However, there was also something called korbanos tzibur, communal sacrifices. And communal sacrifices were primarily the two daily korbanos, what we call korbanos tamid, the daily lamb that was brought in the morning and the daily afternoon lamb, and then the musaf korbanos, the additional ones that were brought on Shabbos, on Yom Tov, on Rosh Chodesh, etc. That all cost a lot of money, and that had to be brought from the communal funds. There was a tax, and this was the machzah shekel. The machzah shekel, the yearly machzah shekel, was given to use for this purpose. It was given to use to buy the sacrifices. Okay, good. That's the idea. Now we find like this. Rashi brings that when the pasuk says ze yitnu. And Hashem says in the second pasuk, right? In the second pasuk, Yud Gimel, the third pasuk, third verse. Pasuk says, Ze yitnu. This is what they should give. This meaning, this is what they should give, the half a shekel. So Rashi says, what does it mean, Ze yitnu? Ze yitnu means that Hashem actually showed Moshe Rabbeinu what to give. What did he do? It says that he showed him a half a shekel of fire, a coin of fire, which Hashem took from under the throne of glory, the Kisei HaKovod. So that Moshe Rabbeinu should understand what to give. Which needs an explanation. What does that mean? So we find in Chazal, this comes from a broader Gemara, or Medrash, we find a couple of things about this. We find, first of all, that there were a number of things where we find the terminology used in the Chumash of Zeh, right? For example, if you go a little bit, just I'll show you. No, I don't know where it is. No, it's not. I thought it was in Parsha Truma, but it must be somewhere else. 1 second. No. Doesn't matter. There's a pasuk with the menorah, right? The menorah says, also, v'zeh ma'aseh ha-menorah. This is the way the menorah should be built, designed in the Mishkan. And Chazal tell us, why does it say v'zeh? This is what the menorah. So it says that Moshe Rabbeinu had great difficulty understanding exactly how the menorah should be built. And Hashem showed him a menorah of fire, so you should understand exactly how it needs to be built, right? We find also a different case. Now, why did Moshe Rabbeinu find it so difficult? Because the menorah was a very complicated design. It had to be made out of one piece of gold. You couldn't make it out of different pieces and weld them together. It had to be out of one piece of gold. You had to sort of fashion it and design it. But yet, the design was very complicated because it had to be six different branches, and each branch has to have a decoration and the flowers and these balls and these cups and all these different things that made the menorah design very difficult, but yet it all had to be made out of one shtick, one piece of gold. So Moshe Rabbeinu found that very difficult to understand how that works. So Hashem showed him a menorah of fire. The Mefarshim asked, why didn't Hashem just make the menorah for him? Because no, the point was that the Yidden had to make the menorah. We had to make the Beis HaMikdash. We had to make the Mishkan. But Hashem showed us how to do it by showing us this menorah of fire. Another case we find, also the word Zeh used, was been by the calendar. It says Hachodesh Hazeh Lochem. A few weeks ago in Parshas Bo, where the first mitzvah was given to the Jewish people as a nation, and Hashem says, this is the month that you should make at the beginning of the month for the calendar of the year. But Hachodesh also means he showed him the Moilad Halavone, he showed him the beginning of the moon, the cycle of the moon, right? In fact, there's a whole interesting thing about that. What happened was like this. Moshe Rabbeinu also found it difficult to understand exactly what that means, the cycle of the moon. And at what point do we consider it Rosh Chodesh? What point do we consider it that the moon has begun its new cycle? So it says that Hashem showed him Chodesh Hazeh. He showed him a new moon. He spoke to him on Rosh Chodesh. And he showed him what the moon looks like at the very beginning of its cycle, so that the Beis Din should always understand how to make Rosh Chodesh based on the birth, what we call the Moilad of the new moon, right? And that, by the way, there's an interesting word, which I saw in one is an interesting answer for, that how could Hashem show him the Moilad HaLevana? We know that the Moilad HaLevana is at night, right? And we have a rule that Hashem only spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu during the day, right? So how does he show him HaKadosh Zelachem? Some of us say that's a problem, because sometimes the moon can be seen at day also, but it's still, it's a shayla, how does it work? So one so interesting answer, you know that we make Rosh Chodesh based on the Moilad HaLevana, based on the birth of the new moon, right? That's why nowadays we have something called Shabbos Mevarchim. You know, the calendar used to be made by a month-by-month thing, right? Every month in the Beis Din, they would wait for witnesses to come and say that they'd seen the cycle of the new moon, they'd seen the new moon, and they would make Rosh Chodesh. Today we have a system, it's called Hillel system, which we just make month-by-month, we already know the system. But in order to commemorate the time where the Beis Din would sanctify the new Rosh Chodesh every single month on a month-by-month basis, so we have this idea that on a Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh, we announce when the Rosh Chodesh is going to be, right? We bless the new month, and that's like the same idea as the Beis Din sanctifying Rosh Chodesh. But because the whole thing was based on the Moilad HaLevana, so we have a minag to announce in Shul when the Moilad HaLevana is going to take place, when will actually be the beginning of the new cycle of the moon, right? That's what you'll hear in Shul, the Moilad will be, etc., etc. such and such a time, and such minutes, and such and such. Chalokim. Chalokim means like parts of an hour. But you'll notice that sometimes we announce the Moled on Shabbos Mevarchim, and we say it's really been. Like, say, it was this morning, and Shchol is going the next day, or whatever, right? How does it actually work? Because we actually don't announce the Moled of the Levana the way it is in Sydney. The Moled of the Levana, the birth of the new moon that we announce in Shul, is the Moled of the Levana of Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim. Oops, sorry. Because the whole system of the new moon was based on the Rosh Chodesh, the way it was done in the Beis Hamikdash, right? So therefore, we announce the whole idea of Rosh Chodesh being based on the cycle of the new moon, it means the cycle of the new moon the way it is in Yerushalayim, not the way it is in here, right? So when we talk about the Moled, it means the Israeli Moled. So therefore, they say like this. It says that Hashem lifted up Moshe Rabbeinu and He showed him the new moon. What happened was like this. Moshe Rabbeinu was in Egypt, right? There's a slight time difference between Egypt and Eretz Yisrael. So they're not exactly in the same line. So what happened was, at the moment where He showed Moshe Rabbeinu the Moled HaLevana, the moon had begun in Eretz Yisrael, but in Mitzrayim it was still day. So when it says that Hashem lifted up Moshe Rabbeinu to show him the Moled, He showed him the Israeli Moled, not the Egyptian Moled. So in Egypt it was daytime, but in Eretz Yisrael it was nighttime. So He showed him the moon, and it wasn't Eretz Yisrael. Okay. So that's another case where we see that Hashem showed Moshe Rabbeinu something, because it says, Hazeh, HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem, right? Because Moshe Rabbeinu had difficulty. We find another case where it says Zeh, and that is a very strange one, where it says, later on, when it talks about Kashrus, and the Torah goes through all the insects that are treif. It also says Zeh, because there's a lot of details there, and Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't sure exactly what it means, and Hashem showed him the insects. So this one's treif, this one's treif, this one's kosher, etc. And then the final time we find it is Machtzis HaShekel, is half a shekel. Moshe Rabbeinu says that difficulty, so it says Zeh Yitnu, so Moshe Rabbeinu showed him the half a shekel. And the obvious question is, what was so difficult about the Machtzis HaShekel? It's a currency, it's all it is. The menorah, we can understand, it's a very intricate design made out of one piece of gold. The Moled HaLevana, the birth of the new moon, is exactly difficult to understand exactly halachas, what's the status of the new moon. The intricate details of kashrus we can understand, but a simple thing like something that's valued at a half a shekel, a coin that's valued at a half a shekel, what's the difficulty? So what did Moshe Rabbeinu find difficult that Hashem needed to show him? The Machtzis HaShekel. And the other thing we have to understand is, what does it mean that Hashem took half a shekel from under the Kisei HaKovei, from under the throne of glory, and He showed it to Moshe Rabbeinu? What's the significance of that? Right? And how was the question answered? Right? So we find a different medrash that's a similar thing, also needs to be understood, a similar thing just to complete the question. Medrash says that there were three things that Moshe Rabbeinu heard and he became frightened. He couldn't understand, like he was shocked. He couldn't understand how it would work. What are the three things? Medrash says that Hashem said he should build a Mishkan. He should build a sanctuary for Hashem, and I will dwell there. So Moshe was shocked. How could the physical donations of the Mishkan, the contributions of the Mishkan, be a place that will house the infinite presence of the Shekhinah? Right? So Hashem answered him, and He says, "Eini mevakeish ela lefi koicha. I'm only asking Yidden to do what they can. In other words, I'm asking them to donate to the Mishkan. They do what they can with the right rotzen, with the right will. Right? And that's fine. And that'll be enough. In other words, I'm not asking to be infinite. I'm not asking to be spiritual. I'm asking to give kechol asher yidvenu libo, it says, the pasuk says, what they want to give. They should give with a whole heart. And that sincerity and that rotzen that they will give to the Mishkan, that will be enough to house my Shekhinah. Good? The second thing is karbonis. When Hashem gave the mitzvah of karbonis, it says in the pasuk that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to command the Jewish people, as karboni lachmi leishoy, bring karbonis, it will be my sustenance, and I'll get nachas from the karbonis. So he said, how can that be? How can it be a yid being an animal? That should be enough to appease Hashem. So Hashem said the same thing. I'm asking them to do what they can. I'm asking them to do whatever they can. So a yid brings a karbon, and he wants to bring a karbon, and he has the rotzen, he has the desire to bring a karbon. That's enough. And the third thing was the Machtzis HaShekel. says in the Torah that Hashem said that we should tell the Yidden to give a half a shekel as koifer nafshoi, as an atonement for their soul. So Moshe Rabbeinu got shocked. He said, how could it be? The half a shekel should be an atonement for their soul? So he was shocked. So Hashem says, no, don't worry. I'll show you what the half a shekel looks like. It's half a shekel of fire. Here is what it looks like, and this will be enough for their koifer nafshoi. So the obvious question is, it doesn't seem to flow. When it comes to the Mishkan, when it comes to the Korbanos, there's a question and there's an answer. The question is, how could the Mishkan be a house for Hashem? How could a human being create a house for Hashem? How could a human being bring a Korban for Hashem that should be acceptable? Hashem's answer is, I'm asking you to do what you can. Do what you can with the right sincerity, with the right will, with the right desire, and it's done. And then I'll count there. Now, with the Mishkan, we know that Yidden had to give what they were asked to give whatever they can. In other words, every Jew, all the materials, the gold, the silver, the copper, they had to give whatever they can. When it came to a Korban we know also has to be given with the Ratzon, also to give with the right desire. Now, the Rambam has a very interesting thing, where sometimes a person is obligated to bring a Korban, is obligated to bring a sacrifice, and he doesn't want to. So, there's a very strange halacha. The halacha is that person, the Beis Din, has to come and force the person, not force the person to bring the Korban, but press the person till they say, yes, I want. It's called Koifin Oisoi Atche Yoima Roitza Ani. You force him, you beat him up until he says, yes, I want, I want, I want. Right? We find that, by the way, two places in Halacha. Right? I'm just building up the whole scenario, you understand what I'm getting in a second. Yeah, a get also, we find it by a Korban, we find it by a get. Right, we find that a person sometimes has to bring a korban and he doesn't want to, so they force him until he says, yes, I want. We find also the malacha with a get. Not always you can force a person to give a get, but there are certain times that a person is obligated al pi halacha to give a get to his wife. And we know that a get has to be berotzen, and a person has to want to give a get, otherwise it's not valid. So there are certain times that it's permitted to strongly encourage the person to say that he wants. Right? So you threaten him until he says, yes, okay, right, Sandy, I really want. And the Rambam asks this question. The Rambam says, what does that mean? Like, I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, he doesn't really want, right? He says, no, it's not true. Everyone really wants to do Hashem's rots. Everyone really wants to do Hashem's will. It's just sometimes outwardly you don't have that desire to do it. You're just not in the mood. There's something blocking you. So therefore, when a person is obligated to do things, something al pi Torah, when you're obligated to do something according to Torah, according to Halacha, really you want to do it. Just so sometimes there's superficial external things that are standing in the way, right? So you remove those external things, you get the person to say that he wants. Once a person declares that he really wants to do the mitzvah, the truth is that he really wants to do it. It's not untrue. Because the true rots and the true desire of the Jew is to actually do the mitzvah. So therefore the Rambam says not such a problem the fact that we're forcing him to say that he wants to do it, because Taki does want to do it. Okay. So ultimately by the Korbanos we understand that at the end of the day there is a rots and there's a desire to do the mitzvah. And Hashem says, that desire to bring the Korban achieves what the Korban has to achieve. When it comes to the Machtzis HaShekel, however, Moshe Rabbeinu was shocked. He says, how's this going to work? Because the halacha of Machtzis HaShekel is, you don't have to want. You get forced to do it. It's a mitzvah you just have to do. And the Rambam says, that brings from the Gemara, that if you don't do it, the Beis Din can force you to do it. Right? The mitzvah of Machtzis HaShekel is a mitzvah, you just have to do it. Whether you want or whether you don't want. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, how's this one going to work? How's this going to work? Koifer nafshoi, it's an atonement for their soul. Doesn't understand. How can that work? How's the Machtzis HaShekel, which you don't have to even want to do, you just have to do it, how's that create a kapara? How's it create an atonement? And also we have to understand is what is the atonement that has to achieve? If we already have a Mishkan, and we already have Korbanos, which is also for Kapara, also for atonement, what is the Kapara for a Machtzis HaShekel? What is the Kapara of half a shekel, and how does it work? And what was Hashem's answer? It's the Matbeah of fire. It says in Rashi, to be exact, that he showed him a fiery coin which weighed a half a shekel. And he took it from under the throne of glory. Three things. He took it from under the throne of glory. It was a coin of fire and it weighed a half a shekel, which is also strange because fire doesn't really weigh much. So what does it mean? The coin of the fire weighed a half a shekel. But the answer is like this. There's different layers to a person's existence, right? We operate, we've discussed this in different ways in different times, but we operate on different levels. And this was Moshe Rabbeinu's problem. You see, sometimes a Yid does what he or she wants, is supposed to do. Sometimes we, you know, we're all fired up. We do Torah mitzvahs, we want to learn, we want to do mitzvahs, so we do the right thing. Sometimes we fall into a trap where we kind of get lazy. We kind of slip into a trap where we don't want to do it outwardly. We don't want to do it, right? But essentially, our Jewishness still exists, right? So for example, when we talk about a korban, why does someone have to bring a korban normally? What type of kapora, what type of atonement do we find that the korban achieves? So the type of kapora, the type of atonement that korbanos achieve are normally for inadvertent sins, for something that a person did b'shoigeg, a mistake. A person broke Shabbos, he did an avera b'shoigeg, so the korban achieves. Why? Because what you do with the korban is you show that really you do have a desire to serve Hashem, but just it got clouded, it got hidden, it got diluted, it got dissolved a bit, so you bring it out again. If you need help bringing it out, so the base can help you bring it out. But essentially the rotzen is there, the desire is there. Moshe Rabbeinu's difficulty with Machzis HaShekel was a whole different difficulty. Because the Machzis HaShekel, the half a shekel, came to atone for the Egel Hazor, for the golden calf. Even though the Torah is written before the Egel Hazor, but it's out of order, right? And here Moshe Rabbeinu did not understand how could there be a kapara, how could there be an atonement for Egel Hazor? Why? Because when a person normally does something wrong, when we normally do something we shouldn't do, it doesn't attack our very core. It doesn't attack our very desire. Really, we all want to do the right thing, right? We all want to serve Hashem. Our basic rotzen, our basic desire is complete. It just, outwardly, our behavior is messed up. We get lazy, we have temptations, we forget, we don't forget, but we think we forget, we whatever the case is, we get messed up very outwardly, but the basic desire of most people is to do the right thing. They might not know that they're supposed to do the right thing, might not know what the right thing is, but our basic rotzen is there. So normally we want to achieve a kapara, all we need to do is to expose our true desire. And our true desire is to serve Hashem. But when it came to the Egel Azov, says Moshe Rabbeinu, the Egel Azov attacked the Jew at the very essence, at the very core of his desire. What is the Egel Azov? The Egel Azov is Avodah Zarah, it's idol worship. Idol worship gets to the very core of who we are. It attacks the very connection that we have with Hashem. So Avodah Zarah attacks a person at the very core essence of his or her Jewishness. It's not just an outwardly, it's not just a superficial blemish. Avodah Zarah is a very deep blemish. So Moshe doesn't understand, it's not like Karbonis or the Mishkan. It's not going to be enough just to expose the true desire, because the true desire is damaged. With Avodah Zarah, the true desire becomes mamash damaged. Avodah Zarah means that a person has not just lost the outer desire to serve Hashem. Avodah Zarah means a person has, in a much deeper way, gone against Hashem and attacked the very essence of who we are. And attacked the very essential desire that we have to serve Hashem. We've rebelled against Hashem. That's Avodah Zarah. So Moshe Rabbeinu's difficulty is, how's Machzis HaShekel, how's the giving of half a shekel going to atone for that? How does that work? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu answers Moshe Rabbeinu a very, very deep idea. He says like this, you're right. But the way to do it is as follows. First of all, it says, he gives him a half a shekel from under the Kisei HaKovim, under the throne of glory. Where do we find that expression of under the throne of glory? It's a very interesting expression. He took the Machzis HaShekel from Tachas Kisei HaKovim, from under the throne of glory. Where do we find that expression? We find that with Neshamas, the souls. Neshamas are taken from under the Kisei HaKovim, it says. Right? So Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu that even when a Jew is attacked at a very deep level, even if the very desire to serve Hashem has been attacked, has been damaged, but there's what we call the etzem hanefesh, the essence of a Jew's soul is always fire, it's always there. It's always there. It never can be, even when you've lost the will, and you've lost the will at a very, very deep level, but there's always a point of the neshama, there's always a pintalayid, there's always a spark a fire which is always complete. Right? How do you bring that out? How do you expose the etzema nefesh? How do you expose the how do you reveal that essential foundation of Jewishness, which is even deeper than the desire we have to serve Hashem? It's just a state of being, it's just there. So we have a rule that goes like this, that the highest of levels manifest themselves in the lowest of levels. Right? It's called Noots Tchilosan Besoifan, that the beginning of something is rooted in the end, and the end of the beginning are always connected. The essence of a Jew's being, the essence of a Jew's connection, is revealed specifically in the lowest form of existence, which is doing, the power of just to do. In other words, Hashem says, this mitzvah, I'm specifically not asking you to want to do. This mitzvah, I'm asking you just to do. Just to do the mitzvah. The behavior, the action. Action is the lowest part of a person's existence, right? We operate on different levels. We think, we feel, we talk, we think, and we do. Doing is the lowest part of our doing. It's just the end of the continuum. The essence of a Jew's neshama comes out in the action of a mitzvah. The action of the mitzvah is much higher than the kavanah of the mitzvah even. Just doing the mitzvah is an expression of just who we are. When you do a mitzvah, even if you don't want to do it, in fact, specifically when you don't want to do it, what that symbolizes is that it's just a state of being. I don't want to do it, I don't feel it, I don't understand it, I'm just doing it. Why are you just doing it? Because that's just me. Because that's who I am. So the essence of a Jew's being, which is deeper than our desire to serve Hashem, has to express itself in a simple action of behavior. Right? And that's what it means, that's a deeper pshat, that Hashem took the machtzis ha-shekel, He took the half a shekel from underneath the kiseh ha-kovei, which is the essence of the soul, and that fire, which is the spark of the neshama, that always exists, weighed half a shekel. It's a very strange thing. How can fire weigh half a shekel? It's these two ideas. When we talk about weight, we're talking about something very physical. Talking about fire, we're talking about something very spiritual. Hashem, that's the way it works. You want to express the deepest spiritual level of the neshama? The way to do it is express it in the lowest form of physicality. Behavior. Just do. Right? Which is why Yiddishkeit is such a Yiddishkeit of action. Right? Because it's such an important idea. Sometimes we always feel, you know, some people say like, I can't do this mitzvah because I'm not up to it. I'm not feel I'm on the madrego. I'm not feel I don't understand it, or I don't feel that I'm not. I don't think I'm there yet. All that kind of stuff, right? It's hypocritical maybe of me, because if I just do it, that means like, but I don't really understand. I don't agree with it even, or I don't feel it, right? Master Shaka says no, because there's a. You might even not want to do it. Even at the very deepest level, you might not want to do it. You might oppose it at the very deepest level, but not at the level of the essence of the soul. The etzma, or the fire from under the kiseh ha-kovet. And you want to expose the fire under the kiseh ha-kovet? Do something. Just bring it out in the mitzvah. Just do it. It's not hypocritical at all. So that was Moshe Rabbeinu's answer. When it came to the machzah shekel, Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't understand, how's this going to work? This is the kapara, this is the atonement for the deepest aveira, the deepest transgression, the thing that attacks the very essence. Hashem said, yeah, that's exactly the mitzvah. This one I'm not even asking you to want to do it. This one I'm asking you, just zeyitnu, just give this. That's the fire from under the kiseh ha-kovet, coming out in the most physical of action. Just do it, and that's the kapara itself. That is the kapara. That is the atonement. Just to force yourself to do it, even though you don't want to. That's the explanation. Okay.
Somebody wouldn't want to give that half shekel.
Sorry?
It's not to think somebody wouldn't want to. I mean, it's such a minimal.
Actually, it wasn't minimal. It was actually quite an expensive coin. And a lot of people, it was a big pinch for them. This was actually quite.
They wouldn't want it purely from that, it's not having.
But a financial, or.
It would look today. Compare it to today.
Yeah, but not spiritually. I mean, not on that level. You know, I took it really as a spiritual thing.
No, true. But I mean, no, it doesn't. It's not a problem to want to do it. The point is that the emphasis is not on your desire. The emphasis is just on the action. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, your will is irrelevant. That's what I'm saying. I'm not asking for your desire because I don't want it. It's just this one. There are things that Hashem asked specifically that He wants you to do it with willingness.
So what I should have said was, in fact, if they didn't want it, would that have purely been a financial...
Possibly, or maybe they were, you know, the Yetzirah. They once got a Yetzirah, and sometimes they want to do things they should do, right? Okay, yeah?
Does it have any relation to
Same sort of idea, yeah. It's a commitment just to do. That's the ultimate subservience to Hashem, is subservience just to do, even though we don't understand. Like, we have this combination of Yiddishkeit. On the one hand, Yiddishkeit is supposed to imbue every part of us. So we're supposed to understand it, we're supposed to want it, we're supposed to be excited about it as much as we possibly can. But there's sometimes an advantage in that not being the case. So sometimes we have to understand that when we're in a position where we actually don't want to do something, then to do it actually in a way is even higher. Which is hard to relate to, but that's the... We don't always feel like that. Sometimes we feel, ah, you know, today I did it, but I didn't, my heart wasn't there. So that's a problem. Of course we have to try and make sure our heart is there, but sometimes it's even better if our heart's not there, because it's a higher mitzvah in a way. Because it's greater, it's a greater commitment, it's a greater subservience.
It's
hard, me. Yeah, that is. It's an important concept.
Okay. The children also have that Kabbalah school, or just coming later,
you mean generally?
In general, like doing it
without understanding. Well, no, it's an education process that we have to educate children as well. That you need to know.
But you're not born with it.
No, not most people aren't born with it. Most people are. you have to train yourself to have it. Most people are born with the Yetzer Hara.
That's the same thing we do in other sense.
Yeah, but we train children to do even though they don't understand it.
Yeah. Regarding the
half
shekel, I assume they actually had currency there.
Yeah, that's all. They had gold and silver.
No, but they got everything from Hashem. I mean, they took with them what they had from Egypt.
Well, it was all from Egypt. It was all from Egypt.
They took with them whatever from Egypt, whether it was theirs, not theirs, whatever they took, right? So then they're in the desert. They're in the midbar. What do they need money for?
Sorry.
They need to serve Hashem this way.
Well, they needed money to build a Mishkan. No, you're right.
Where would the individual, but I understand where.
No, they got it from Mitzrayim. They took with them the half a shekel from Mitzrayim.
So Hashem, that was the
case. Yeah. I suppose. Okay, I must be.
Sorry.
I imagine. I suppose. Yeah. I'm not. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I imagine.
So. They're all going to have to try and manufacture this.
No.
Tell you
sorry? They were self-sufficient, but not communally. In other words, they were self-sufficient, but they had all this gold and silver, and I suppose coins as well from Mitzrayim.
Yeah.
And then I suppose there was some trade. In other words, there must have been some concept where how you're going to, like to build the Mishkan, they each had needed to donate, right?
Yeah.
But they were individually rich, but they weren't communally rich necessarily. So when they had to build the Mishkan, everyone had to give stuff up. And I suppose when they needed to bring this... buy the animals for Kabbonis, which they bought from each other, I suppose, because they all came with animals and stuff. They still have to do with currency, I suppose, I imagine. Yeah.
But Rabbi Roy, why we read this parsha, especially like the book, what's the connection of the...
Okay, so that's like it's like we always read, because we're going to reread this, it's this week's parsha, but we're going to reread it again on Parshat Shkalim, right?
Yeah.
Which is the parsha before Rosh Chodesh Adar, yeah, which is close to Purim. So the simple answer, halachic answer for the reason is like this: that we read it before Purim because we read it before Rosh Chodesh Adar because the way it used to work is the cycle of the karbonis, the cycle of the sacrifice in the Beis Hamikdash was from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, every year they would buy the animals for the sacrifice with the new funds that came in that year. So what they would do is the month of Adar in the time of the Beis Hamikdash was the month where everyone would fulfill the mitzvah of giving half a shekel. So the Gemara says that on Rosh Chodesh Adar, they would send out big notices, you know, tax notices that it's time to pay up your half a shekel. And the month of Adar was the month of collection. That's why, to remember the Beis Hamikdash, we read that on the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Adar. That's a simple reason. But there's a deeper reason, because it says that actually there is a connection, because Haman offered Ahasuerus lots of kesef, lots of silver, right? And it says there when he offered Ahasuerus lots of silver in exchange for the Jewish people, a heavenly voice came out and said, you're being silly, because the Jewish half a shekel preceded your shekels, your money, right? And therefore, in other words, as if to say that the story of Purim, ultimately the salvation, of course the Yidden, the Tshuva and all that, but the salvation came in the merit of half a shekel, right? So the question is always asked, what's the connection between half a shekel and Purim? But actually the discussion we just had is very connected, because Purim is very much the same idea. Purim is a yontif of darkness, right? It's a yontif of golos. We always say that it's different to all other yontif. It's a yontif where Hashem's name was completely hidden. It's like the darkest of exiles, where we don't see Hashem, we don't see miracles, we don't none of the spiritual consciousness that people used to have at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. They weren't fired up. They were just very, very low, spiritually speaking, right? And therefore it says, what is the Yontav of Purim symbolizes? It's very much, Yontav is very much Purim of action. It's about just serving Hashem, notwithstanding that he's not obvious, notwithstanding that we can't understand it. Right, which is really the message of half a shekel. That's the whole idea of half a shekel. You don't need your will, just you got to do it. Right, and that's why Hashem says, you'll see that although it's time of Golus, time of exile, which that was the opportunity that Haman used, because he thought he could attack the Jewish people during Golus, but sometimes it's specifically during the Golus where a Jew is able to reveal this essence of the soul, more than the Beis HaMikdash. See, in the Beis HaMikdash, people served Hashem because they were fired up, because they saw Hashem and they saw miracles and they had love of Hashem and fear of Hashem. Where do we have the opportunity to take a reveal this very deepest level of the soul where we connect it to Hashem, notwithstanding that we don't understand or see or anything like that? That's the Afghan time of Golis, and that's the Yontav of Purim. That's why the half a shekel is connected to Purim. Okay. Let's have a look at one other thing in the parasha. I'm not thinking we're going to get to the golden calf today, but we've done other years. Anyway, have a look at page 492. Let's start on 490. Okay. Because this parasha comes very much in the parashas that have to do with the Mishkan, we suddenly have again the mitzvah of Shabbos, right? So let's have a look at that little bit of the parasha. It says like this, Pasuk, page 490, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, right? It says, Vayomer Hashem Moshe Leimra, Hashem Moshe to Moshe Rabbeinu saying. This is after Hashem has finished commanding exactly what has to take place in building the Mishkan. It says, Ve'ato, and you, Dabir Obene Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people, Leimar to say, Ach, Eshab Soisai Tishmeiru, but, the word Ach means but, my Shabbos you should guard. Ki oisi beini uveneichem, it's a sign between me and you, the Doir HaSeichem of all the generations, excuse me, Ladas, Ki ani Hashem Kadishchem, to know that I am Hashem who makes you holy. Right? So what does the word ach mean? But. So the simple pshat in the pasuk is that this was coming after Hashem had finished commanding what has to be done for the Mishkan. Because you know, Parshas Truma, Hashem commanded all the various vessels of the Mishkan and the walls and the curtains. Last week's Parsha Tetzaveh, right? Hashem commands to build, to make the clothing, the garments of the Kohuna. At the end of the Parsha we have the Mizbeach Hazov, the golden altar. In this week's parasha, between the Machtzis HaShekel, and also we just have, I skipped it over, but we have the commandment to build the sink, the basin, and also to get together all the incense and the concoction they had to make in order to prepare the incense for the building of the Mishkan, right? Then Hashem ends it off, I should have done a little bit before, just go back to page 488, at the bottom. Hashem says, who's going to be in charge of the Mishkan, right? It says, "Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Leimar." Hashem spoke to Moshe and is saying, "Re'ei." He says, "Have a look. Karosi b'shem Betzalel ben Uri ben Chur l'mati Yehuda. I've called the name of Betzalel. Betzalel was that individual who was the project manager for the Mishkan, right? So I've called him. He was the son of Uri ben Chur l'mati Yehuda. And Hashem says, "Va'amale oisa ruach halakim." I filled him with the spirit of Hashem, b'chachma b'svuna, with wisdom, with understanding, b'das b'chol malacha. Right? I filled him with tremendous understanding because to build the Mishkan required an amazing skill and an amazing amount of physical and also spiritual understanding. It wasn't just about the physical desire, it was also to understand what went into the Mishkan spiritually. And Hashem said, I filled this individual with tremendous, tremendous wisdom, and he will be able to build the Mishkan. And I've also given him Aliyah ben Achisamach, he will help him out, etc., etc. Led by Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, right? Then all of a sudden Hashem says, ah, but my Shabbos you should keep. So simply, what does that mean? It means that the Mishkan was an amazingly important building, and I've given Bezalel tremendous wisdom in order to know how to build it, but it does not override the Shabbos. So although the building of the Mishkan was such an important building, nevertheless it wasn't permitted to be built on Shabbos, right? Which, by the way, is how we actually learn what is prohibited on Shabbos. Because the basis of the prohibitions of Shabbos is anything that went into building the Mishkan, we know is prohibited on Shabbos. So that's how we learn the 39 melachas, the 39 prohibited activities. Okay, that's on one level. However, the usage of the word ach is very interesting. Ach, you know, but you should keep my Shabbos. And we have a klal in halacha, in Torah Shabbat Peh, in the oral law, whenever the Torah says ach, it means to exclude something. So when it says ach, it's an exception to the rule. In other words, when it says ach eshapsoisa tishmoiru, but you shall keep my Shabbos, in other words, Shabbos shall not override the Mishkan, ach means an exception, which means there's an exception to the rule, that there's sometimes you don't have to keep Shabbos. What is that? So this is one of the sources that the Gemara uses to learn the idea of pikuach nefesh. Right? And Aruch Chaim brings that as well. Pikuach nefesh. If someone's life is in danger, that Shabbos is overridden. Shabbos doesn't exist, and you can do whatever you need to do to save that person's life. So the Chassam Sofer points out an interesting thing. He says like this. He says, we know that at the very beginning of Chumash, it says, Bereshis bara elokim. Hashem created the world. Creation, right? The Targum says, what does Bereshis bara elokim mean? B'chuchmas sabara. Hashem created the world with chokhmah. There was a wisdom, certain wisdom that went into the creation of the world. Then when it comes to the Mishkan, right? When it comes to the Mishkan, or the Mikdash as it's called in the Chumash, also required this amazing wisdom, as we just learned, that Hashem said, I will fill Bezalel with this tremendous wisdom in order to know how to build a Beis HaMikdash. In fact, as some sort of points out, that the Mishkan was a creation that was higher than the creation of the world. He brings it in a pasuk, that there's a pasuk that says, when Hashem created the world, the imagery that it says is that Hashem created the world with His hand, with His right hand. When it says about the Beis HaMikdash later on, when we say it every day in the davening, in the Shira, it says, Mikdash Hashem koinenu yodecha, that Hashem's hands established the Beis HaMikdash, two hands, rather than one hand. In other words, the creation of the Mishkan is even stronger than the creation of the world, right? So that the Mishkan is on a higher level than the creation of the Mishkan was on a higher level than the creation of the world. Then he says we find all of a sudden that Shabbos, however, overrides the Mishkan. So Shabbos obviously is on a higher level even than the Mishkan. Okay, so we've got the world. Higher than the world is the creation of the Mishkan. Higher than the Mishkan is Shabbos, because Shabbos does not override the Mishkan. Sorry, Shabbos overrides the Mishkan, and the Mishkan doesn't override Shabbos. And you cannot build the Mishkan on Shabbos. So the Shabbos is obviously this great connection between us and Hashem, that is so holy that it even transcends the holiness of the Mishkan. And then all of a sudden, says the Sefer, we find that the existence of a Jew is even higher than Shabbos. Right? Because when it comes to Ach, Shabbosai Sait Yishmoiru, right? That when it comes to the existence, if the existence of a Jew is in jeopardy, then it overrides the Shabbos. Right? And we know, of course, he doesn't say this, but this is based on a Medrash, that the Medrash says that we know there are two things that preceded the world, the Jew and the Torah. Torah and Yisrael. And then says the Medrash, which one came first? Which one's higher than the other? In other words, they're both higher in the world. Which one's higher? So it says, we look in the Torah. The Torah says, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, speak to the Jews. So obviously the Jew comes first. What does that mean? It means, in essence, the Neshama is completely one with Hashem. The Neshama is higher than Torah. That doesn't mean we can undermine the importance of keeping Torah, because the Jew's importance becomes revealed through the Torah. In other words, how do we know? So it's only through the Torah that we're actually able to nurture and develop our importance and our connection. But nevertheless, the Jew's existence is higher than the Torah. This is what we learn from this week's parsha, where the creation of the world, the Mishkan, higher than the Mishkan is Shabbos, higher than Shabbos is the Yid. So he says, this is hinted. This is hinted in Shema, he says. Because the word Shema is an acronym for Shabbos Mikdash Oilam. Right? Shema is Shin Mem Ayin, Shabbos Mikdash. Mikdash is based on Mikdash. Oilam is the world. And then after Shema, after Shabbos Mikdash Oilam, you have Yisrael. Shema Yisrael, Yisrael the Yid. Yid is even higher than Shabbos Mikdash Oilam. Amazing pshat, right? Yeah? And that's why you have it in this order. You have the commandment to build the Mishkan, then the Shabbos, and then built into the Pesukim of Shabbos, you have Ach, however, sometimes there's an exception, and the Yid, when it's a conflict between the Yid and Shabbos, the Yid is even higher. And that's because the Yid ultimately is even higher than Shabbos. Good. We'll stop there.
Thank you.